Patricia.
Welcome back. I trust everyone's juices are flowing.
Good conversation.
Make sure I have a quorum here. Good to go. Okay, so we left off business prior to lunch with some preliminary public comments on the hydraulic code rulemaking, and, for which I was very appreciative. We're going to move into some staff discussions and report on the rulemaking itself, and so I'm going to call Mark Engel up to provide that for us, and then we'll proceed with discussing our action items.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I am still Mark Engel of the DNR. So the next agenda item is the Forest Practice Hydraulic Project rulemaking. I think most all of the history you're aware of, but this is a rulemaking that has been necessitated by the legislature through their passing in 2012 of Second and Gross Substitute Senate Bill 6406, which in Part 2 of the legislation requires incorporation of fish protection standards in the hydraulic code into the forest practices rules. To achieve full incorporation of the hydraulic projects in the forest practice rules, the legislation required WDFW to adopt a rule establishing a concur review process, which they have already done. DNR and WDFW to establish an MOA by the end of December of last year to establish a process to implement integration of hydraulic projects into the Forest Practice applications, which we did do. I believe it was December 21st the MOA was signed. And as Chris Mendoza said earlier, this rulemaking, when accomplished, will require an enormous amount of cooperation between WDFW and DNR on how to integrate this on the ground. Also require a lot of training for landowners, and DNR will have to change forms and the instructions. So the MOA there's a lot of insight in requiring that. In addition, as was discussed this morning, the legislation required the DNR to develop a forest practice hydraulic project board manual to provide guidance and, in fact, good quality examples of hydraulic projects for landowners to refer to in designing their projects as part of the forest practice application. And I wasn't up here this morning, but I also want to take a little pause here and really thank all the individuals who have helped in the board manual process. Specifically, I want to point out Gretchen on my staff. She's done fabulous work. She's very tenacious. And as an individual earlier acknowledged, she was very quick on the turnaround and getting information back out to folks, which I think really enhanced the process and allowed it to go as well as it has. I also want to thank in the draft rulemaking, the help from Department of Fish and Wildlife, and a lot of input from stakeholders, including industry. I unlike Gretchen, have not counted how many meetings we held in the development of the rules, but it was pretty darn close to the same number as it took to develop the board manual. So many, many days in this whole rule package. Again, point out to the draft board manual is posted online for people to reference when they're reviewing the rules, and they really do go together in the review. So without any further ado, because there's been so much discussion around this, I am here to officially request that the board give approval to board staff to file a CR 102 with the Forest Practice Hydraulic Project draft rule language.
Thanks, Mark. Got a couple of questions that that I think might tee up our action item and our path forward on this. And one is that, you know, for board members' benefit, and those of you that are sort of familiar with administrative procedures will know that that which we put into the 102 draft rule stage needs to be sort of, the public needs to be able to respond to that in a way that they understand what the choices are and that it's within the scope of rule that we end up changing issues at the final rule stage that haven't really afforded anyone an opportunity to comment on. That causes us a procedural issue. We really do need to have the full range of the decision space within the scope of the rules. And so, Mark, is it possible to construct a draft rule, a 102 rule, in such a way that has some different options in it that the public could respond to, for example, along the lines of some of the issues we heard from different folks about this morning?
Yes, it's possible. We can publish for example, two definitions, and for people to review and for us to gain public comment on during this process.
And in mechanically, is that going to cause us an issue with the timelines for implementation as far as the mandatory comment periods and filing deadlines with the Office of Code Advisor? Is it feasible for us to get all that done in the way we envision between now and the August board?
Yes, it is. Depending on how much the change is, so the Office of the Code Advisor has two dates that you have to get all the materials to them in each month, and then after which they post the materials in the state register. An integral part of the CR 102 process is that the form, the CR 102 form along with the associated materials have to be published in the state register for a period of time before we can hold our first public hearing. Under the Administrative Procedures Act, we have to do both. We have to file a 102 and we have to hold a public hearing and give the public opportunity to make comment on the draft rules before we bring them back to before the board for the board's final review and adoption. But yes, we could make, we could put out a dual draft language from which the public can make comments, and we could do that in a timely manner to meet the current timeline that we have before the board. In other words, bring it back by the August meeting.
Questions for Mark?
How long is our comment period? How many public hearings and where?
I don't know the length of the comment period, but we have scheduled two public hearings. And at this point in time, we've already secured the location and the dates. And depending on the board's actions today, what we intended to do was to have each public hearing would be a dual hearing, one for the adaptive management program reform, and then followed up by the Forest Practice Hydraulic Project. I believe the first hearing is in Ellensburg at the DNR Southeast Region office, and the second hearing would be here in this room.
And end of June.
And they, right now they're scheduled for the end of June.
I believe the comment period is 30 days.
Well, it's roughly a month is our comment period.
So. I have a great staff, so.
Yeah, well, I know that usually there's a minimum and a maximum.
So in the context of an option such as the one you described here, if you change a definition, there are all kinds of conforming changes in reference to that definition throughout the rule, typically. And I think it's still rational and logical for folks to look at two different definitional options and then just have to sort of think for themselves about where those terms might appear later in the rule rather than having to have two full sets of rules, or really four, if we, for example, had two different options for two different definitions. But just in terms of staff work and meeting the timeline for getting this in front of the code advisor, it seems like that's still something folks would be able to respond to. So.
Yeah, I think it would be appropriate for staff to describe, I guess, the how we've configured the rules and what we're really asking people to review. Stumbling for words here, but if, for example, we had two definitions, I think it would be in our best interest to describe not only the full rule package that's before people and why it's there, but also the reason for each of the definitions. And then from that, I would think that the people would be able to as they look at the rest of the rules, reflect back on the definitions when they make comments as to which one would serve them best.
Any questions for Mark? Okay, we're ready for our action item. We can do this either as a procedural matter. We can do this on a basic motion to initiate, direct staff to initiate the 102, and then amend it to address some of the other issues that we've discussed here this morning, or we can do it all at once. It'll be probably more painful if we do it in stages, because I'm going to have to take 3 or 4 different votes on things. So I'm hopeful that we can bring some language up on the screen. Ding, ding, ding. And so the basis of this hypothetical motion would be to move the Forest Practices Board approve for public review the draft Forest Practices Hydraulic Project Rule Proposal, amending Title 222 WAC to incorporate the hydraulic code. In the Forest Practices Rules, I further move the board direct staff to file CR 102 with the Office of the Code Advisor to initiate permanent rulemaking. And based on the discussion, the exchange we just had, what might come as a form of motion is maybe to split or pick up after that first sentence and add some specific language with respect to the two definitions that have been raised in public comment here today. And for the sake of expediency, why don't I try and take a run at that? Okay, so why don't you say with the following amendments? Colon, and then give me some bullets. To include the proposed rule definition of Forest Practices Hydraulic Project as well as an alternate definition which excludes silly trackball, which excludes type N water. I'm going to get through the rest of the language and we can come back and amend this further once we've got a motion on the floor. So next bullet. To include the proposed rule definition of bank hole width as well as an alternate definition of the term ordinary high water line. I think it's line in statute.
Oh.
Okay. Give me ordinary high water mark slash line. Okay. So let's consider that motion from the chair. And do I have a second on the motion?
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. So let's have some discussion on this and perhaps some amendments for clarity, since doing this on the fly isn't necessarily the most thorough way to go about it. The intent here is simply to recognize that changes along the lines that we're talking about in response to comments here this morning have issues of interpretation associated with them, have downstream and related rule impacts associated with them, that in terms of our deliberations here as a body today, we're probably not going to be able to fully vet and resolve. This is a way of proceeding with the rulemaking that contains dual definitions for the purpose of sideboarding and bookending that through public comment process. We can receive comments and responses from those who are engaged and interested in this process under these two sort of alternatives. It doesn't seem to me to cause us the problem when we arrive at the stage of 103 to not have had due and full consideration and comment on the issue in front of us and all the related stuff that pertains to the definition. So that's the intent here. And with that, I think it's probably well to pause and see if there are any amendments to the motion for clarification's sake, so, or suggestions from staff.
Yeah, on type N, I would say type N waters.
And that's a non-substantive amendment that probably doesn't need to be amended.
And on the term ordinary high water mark slash line as defined in the hydraulic code.
That's consistent with my intent. So it's, you can cite the statute if we wanted to. Other clarifications, potential amendments?
I know we know what we're talking about. We're not really providing an alternate definition for substantive terms.
The alternate definition in the context of an alternative in the rule itself? And so that's a suggestion on how to clarify that?
Yeah. That's a great job.
So the second one, the second bullet is fairly clear on that subject. The first one is less clear.
I think the first bullet is clear.
Okay. Why don't we say, after the word alternate, why don't we insert the word rule? Consider that a friendly amendment in both cases.
Rule.
Just the word rule under both bullets. Okay. So it's clear that the intent, and hopefully we captured in the minutes as well, that we're using, particularly in the second case, we're just using a direct sort of drag and drop statutory definition. So we're not changing that definition in the way it exists at all. We're just evaluating the option to use one or the other one.
A little confused. Is definition the right thing for bank full width versus ordinary high water mark, or is it? I'm just a little confused. Is there some more clarity?
Like term versus term.
It's in the definition section of the proposed rule.
Is it?
Yeah. So in the first practice rules, the term art is bank full width. What this would mean is that we would add a definition of bank full width for the purposes of first practice hydraulic projects. So it would be an additional definition of bank full width. The current definition of bank full width still applies to the establishment of RMZs and all the other parts of the well.
Help clarifying motion?
Question, I don't know if this is going to complicate matters. I'm just picking up on what Dave was saying. I think we all understand it. But in the first bullet, so we're going to include the proposed definition as well as an alternate rule definition, which duplicates the original proposal but excludes type N. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does it need that point of clarification or not? I defer.
Which duplicates.
And which we could do the same thing in the second bullet as well, but I don't know if it's duplicative.
So run that language suggestion by me again.
How about right after which, right there, it would basically say which duplicates the proposed the current proposed definition, but excludes type N from that definition, or something that's much more
consistent. Well, a similar alternative rule definition above, which excludes.
So
our I don't know if we need to be
council
that.
Has a
Mr. Chair, one alternate idea would be to say that the intent, you know, in the motion, one alternate idea would be to say the intent is that at the 103 stage, the board would make a choice among the definitions rather than tweaking the language.
Excellent. Without objection, we'd maybe back off, Gretchen, from the stuff you just added, and then perhaps down under the motion, part of the motion that addresses filing 102 to express a sentence of intent about choosing between the two when we reach the stage of CR 103. So that would read, it is the board's intention. To select one of the alternate definitions. At final rulemaking. In other words,
well, not one of the alternates.
Not one of the alternates.
Just either.
Yeah. We got.
Or select a definition.
Yeah.
Select a definition. Sure. There?
Not quite.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm brain numb. Just looking at, I think it makes it clear the, just in common language, we're saying there's two different definitions, one with type N in it, one without.
Correct.
And then the way the it's written now, it has bank full width, and we would be determining it the end of the process, whether it's bank full width or ordinary high watermark. That's kind of the path. That's, just want to make sure
yes.
That's saying what I just said in a, probably a more succinct manner.
Is there a clarification you've got to suggest for me?
I guess I'm getting hung up on the word definition. It's
that was the same thing I
was it's about. Selecting a word.
Alternative.
Okay. Select final definition language. Select definition language.
Do you have that source?
I don't.
Want me to do that?
No, I'm just being facetious.
Select among the definitions?
Among the, yeah.
Between.
You see where it's going in terms.
Yeah.
Or it, one's the definition. The first one's a definition.
The other is,
language.
Yeah.
All of which remains within the definition portion of the rule. And that's
all right. So as long as we have the intent, or hopefully.
The intent is. we've got two different definitional options on both of these terms, right? Force practice hydraulic project and either of the two, bank full width versus ordinary high water, in as much as they pertain to force practices hydraulic projects. Clear? I think between the motion and the minutes, we probably got it licked. We have the recording. Right. Yeah, you can always go back and replay it on TVW. We'll relive the pain on TVW of being a motion craft on the line. Further discussion on the motion.
Did you have somebody move in second?
Moved. Mr. Laurie second. And we were perfecting in the form of non-substantive clarifications.
Dave second.
Sorry, Dave second. My apologies. Okay. Ready? Call a question?
No.
No.
I don't remember. So I'm done with that. I just want to talk generally about the rule. Norm brought up a good point about some details on how things are applied relative to bridge maintenance or overpass stream crossing maintenance. And I just want to acknowledge that those are things that we're going to be very interested in hearing testimony on and things that can be clarified in the rule process and going forward here, I think. So I encourage testimony on that, and obviously anything else in the rule that we need to pay attention to. That's it.
Fair enough.
Can I...
last chance for amendments on the motion.
Could we... is this just bugging me, definition? It's not fitting in my prep days. Can we switch definition to language in the second bullet? Proposed rural language of Bankville with...
just, oh, I should use the word language?
Instead of definition, because they're not really definitions, they're languages.
So let's turn to our let's clarify this before we move on and make sure we have comfort. Mark, can you direct me to the right page here? My eyes glaze over a number of times I've looked at this.
The page 463 is the beginning of general definitions.
Yep.
And it's actually on page 5 is the definition of forest practice hydraulic project. And then, let me find the other one. I just realized it's the definition for Bankville width.
For solving the lack of definition.
Is the current definition in the rule, so you do not possess it in your packet because it is current definition.
So the second bullet would then be instead of an alternate rule definition, it would be an additional rule definition.
Sure.
How's that? Yeah. So in other words,
if I may, I think what the real question here is that, again, in the forest practice rules, our term art is thankfulness. So the question before you now is, do you want to maintain the current definition of bankful width and apply it towards all forest practice hydraulic projects, or do you want to add an additional definition of bankful width for hydraulic projects, forest practice hydraulic projects? I think that's the real question right here.
Yep, that's why the word additional. Additional rule definition of the term ordinary high water mark slash line.
And just to clarify, we're spending time on the actual language, but to go back to the meaning, the comments we heard from the industry caucus this morning were actually requesting that alternative to use
correct.
Ordinary high water mark slash line instead of bankful width. Is that right?
Correct. Further clarification. All right. We good?
We're A-okay.
Sounds great. All right, now we will call the question. So the motion on the floor is to proceed to CR 102 with optional rule definition and a strong intent of the board to choose among those at the final stage. This allows us to enable full public review of these options and get a little better sense of what it all means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Abstentions?
Abstain.
Okay. Yeah. Did you guys get the no on abstention?
Yep.
Got
the abstention,
it.
I didn't.
That was David?
It was the no.
Bill? Thank you all very much. We're off and running. Next item of business is a post-lunch public comment period, followed by a senior 2014 work plan and budget comment period. I think I'll take the post-lunch general public comment right now, and then what I'd like to do, unless there's an objection, because we have folks joining us from afar to discuss the matter of petition for rulemaking on the Western Grade School, I'd like to move that ahead of the senior work plan and budget on the agenda, unless there's an objection. Hearing none. General public comments. We have Mr. Shaw. Please come join us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Norm Schaaf, Carol and Ring. Just hearing this discussion, I would bring to your attention several points. Sometimes you wish you were a fly on the wall or you could poke somebody on the shoulder when you're all sitting up there and you could offer a word. Bankful width and ordinary high water mark are really parameters around which development occurs on forest practices. So it might be a better choice of words than whatever you've got in there. And you could even consider going back and changing what you just passed. Going through real quickly the proposed rule, there are at least 10 instances that refer to bankful width. And of course, those the use of bankful width as opposed to ordinary high water mark or ordinary high water line may have a significant impact on costs of actually accomplishing whatever development is occurring. The other issue, of course, is whether or not we go with type N streams remaining in the rule or out of the rule. All of these have significant cost implications, and it brings me to question whether or not an economic analysis is required when one is considering the range of alternatives that you have just put forward. I'm not trying to add work to anybody, but it is definitely becoming more complex and much more difficult to understand what the true impact of this rule may be when it is finally adopted. And I'm not trying to slow it down at all in any way. Like I said at the very beginning this morning, I support moving forward with this integration, but it may take a quick relook and see if this is really what you want to do. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to bump our Western Gray Squirrel discussion again, as I said before, ahead of the senior 2014 work plan and budget. First, we have a 10-minute public comment opportunity on the petition for rulemaking, which we've received and you all have in your packets. And so we've got folks signed up for that, I imagine. Adrian Miller, please come join us.
Good afternoon. My name is Adrian Miller, and in this capacity, I'm representing Longview Timber, and I'm here to ask you to not grant the rule petition for you, primarily because I believe that the issues raised in the rule petition already can be addressed by existing authorities within the Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Natural Resources. Additionally, I feel that the incident raised in this particular petition is likely an isolated incident, and I believe that those authorities that both departments have, should they choose to exercise them, would be sufficient to address this. And probably more importantly is the recognition that forest landowners who operate in the range of the Western Gray Squirrel are extremely aware of the species, aware of its habitats, aware of the voluntary guidelines that exist, and consistently work with both departments to implement site-specific guidelines for the species. And lastly, I'd just like to, I know Dave is keenly aware, but you make the rest of the board aware that many landowners are actually investing in research on the Western Gray Squirrel, working with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to better understand many aspects of the population dynamics in the region, survey techniques, and potentially the interaction with contemporary forest practices. And for those reasons, I think granting the rule petition at this point in time would be premature. Thank you.
Thanks, Adrian. Rob Cavanaugh, please come join us.
Good afternoon. My name is Rob Cavanaugh, and I'm a friend of all Western gray squirrels, and I'm here to petition you for rulemaking to protect the Western gray squirrel, not only the nesting trees, but the habitat that's required for the survival of the Western gray squirrel populations in this state. We have RCW 7715 that was designed by Fish and Wildlife to protect Western gray squirrels. But what I'm finding, and when I talk with field staff, is there's not clarity and there's not good definition of where the fine lines lie between a nest tree and protective habitat. And therein lies the problem of survival of Western gray squirrels. Can you imagine if we found a nest tree with a Western gray squirrel nest up in it, and there were babies in that nest, and we cut all the adjacent habitat down? The squirrels would not survive. You could not have a viable population under those conditions. And so the Department of Fish and Wildlife has defined the habitat needs of a nesting gray squirrel. And they have defined the kinds of habitat, the tree species, and the conditions that it will take for survival of a viable population of Western gray squirrels within the landscape. So that's where we're looking at. We're looking for clarification and definition that will aid both the private landowners, the commercial timber companies, and the two agencies to protect and enhance viable populations of Western gray squirrels in the landscape where they naturally would exist. And I'm happy to tell you that the U.S. Forest Service is in full cooperation. And I just returned from an inspection trip of a forest health project in Klickitat County that was designed specifically to protect Western gray squirrels. It is a fine example of what forestry can do. We do harvest, we do commercial thinning of the Doug fir stands, we do generate revenues. So it's not a threat to the logging industry at all. So it can be done, but I think we've got to seek clarity in rules and regulations. One thing I did learn is that you have 9 inspectors that do forest practice rule inspecting. I was not aware of that. They mainly do timber theft work, but they do have authority to enforce RCW 77. Now, we were told by the department staff they would not enforce RCW 77 because the county prosecutors were not amenable to enforcement. I know the prosecutor, I called her up and she said, you get it to me, go through the sheriff's department, if the DNR and wildlife won't do it, I will prosecute. So it can be done. And I have to say also that today I got a call from Fish and Wildlife and they said, we are now agreeable to enforcing the protection of Western gray squirrels. But they need clarity and definition in the rulemaking. You know, this feel-good, voluntary compliance, it doesn't work in the real world of logging and timber operations. You have to define, you have to be specific, and you have to reach agreement and consensus. So that's why we need rulemaking. And the Western gray squirrel is waiting your action. Their survival depends on it. I first gave this briefing 22 years ago before the Board of Natural Resources. I see nobody here that was here then. You all look so young. But that's when we started trying to protect the Western gray squirrel. Do you have any questions?
Questions for board members? Thank you, Mr. Cavanaugh.
Actually, I do have a question for you, Mr. Cavanaugh. What's your reaction to the assertion that better enforcement of existing regulations would solve the problem versus creating a new rule under forest practices? That's my first question. And the second is, would this be a better, would the clarifications better occur through Fish and Wildlife Commission rulemaking versus Board Practices Board rulemaking?
In answer to your first question, my concern is that the existing rule will protect a nest tree, but what happens after that? You've got a squirrel and a nest tree and nothing else around it. This squirrel is part of an ecosystem, and it depends on all the interrelations, depends on how you define forest. A forest is not just one single fir tree. It's the composite of all the interrelations of the species and diversity around it. And that's what it takes to have a viable population of western gray squirrels. And as to your second question, I am pessimistic. When these kinds of issues get up at the higher levels in the Department of Fish and Wildlife, it's kind of wet your finger and hold it up in the air and see how the wind blows. And if it's politically unacceptable, then you're not going to see much effort made at the top levels. And one other thing, at the top levels there is a complete problematic problem of integration and coordination in fish and wildlife that does not exist in DNR. I have absolute confidence in DNR's ability to manage natural resources. But when you get into wildlife, it's politics. It's incredible. And that is what has happened to the Western Gray Squirrel. It got into the assistant division level of Lisa Werner also. I've dealt with her on wetlands issues and on shrub step grazing issues. And it science disappears and it's all politics. And with the DNR, science is the foundation of your decision making. Good practical science and good effective management. I have never seen such an effective management group of people in all my years of dealing with the DNR as we have right now. They're really a competent group of people, and I have utmost confidence in them that I don't have in Fish and Wildlife. So does that answer your question?
Thank you, Mies.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay. Mark and Gary Bell, come join us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
if I may. In response to the petition, what we had discussed and what the board is going to be presented with today, right now, is a bit of a tag team between Mark and Gary and then myself as well. At the very end, just to try to inform the board on some of the past history of western gray squirrels, nuts and bolts of the habitat requirements, the species, etc., and also the past board history, because back in 90, it was listed in 93, and in 96, the board undertook some discussion and deliberations on potential habitat rule. Not a nest tree protection rule, but a habitat rule. And so we're going to go through that, and at the end, I'm going to offer what our department is thinking about and recommending that we discuss at the very least in terms of response to the petition and then also next steps on habitat protection guidelines, et cetera. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about what Department of Fish and Wildlife is going to be doing in the very near future in response to this particular forest practice application and our statutes. One point I did want to make, though, is that DNR enforces the forest practices rules, which are very not just complex, but they're cut and dry. It's a rule book, and when DNR enforces those and administers those rules, Department of Fish and Wildlife doesn't have much authority at all. We set hunting and fishing seasons, and we have HPA authority, which we have our own set of rules for. And beyond that, in terms of wildlife protection, we don't have authority. The only authorities we have are statutory and rule authority over bald eagles, and then our statutes that Mr. Kavanaugh is referencing pertain to nest protection for endangered and protected wildlife. And some of those definitions, as I'll get into later, some of those statutes are, the language in there is somewhat problematic. And so I wanted to lay that foundation for everybody, that it is, we do follow science, we just don't have a lot of authority to do that with. So it becomes much more complicated than simply implementing forced practice rules, which is very difficult in and of itself. What I would describe as probably a more difficult job because of the lack of authority. So.
Mark. Thanks, Dave.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, for the record, I'm Mark Engel with Doing Our Forest Practices. Before Gary gives a presentation on the forest squirrel, I just want to inform the board that any person may submit a petition to the board requesting the adoption, amendment, or repeal of the rule. Forest Practice Board staff received on April 15th the petition that is before you. The petition was for rulemaking to devise and pass new forest practice rules similar to wildlife's to enable DNR staff to protect the nest trees of the western gray squirrel. The board must no later than 60 days after receipt of this petition, or by June 14th, make a decision to initiate rulemaking proceedings in accordance with Chapter 3405 RCW, which is the Administrative Procedures Act. Deny the petition in writing stating its reasons for the denial and specifically addressing the concerns stated in the petition. Where appropriate, the board will indicate alternate method means by which the board will address the concerns raised in the petition. And if the board denies the petitioner may appeal the denial to the Joint Administrative Rules Review Committee, the governor, and the Superior Court. So with that, I open up the presentation by Gary. I just want the board to be aware of what this means before you right now.
So the presentation is just a little bit of Squirrel 101 to give you a background of what some of their ecology and their life history requirements are. And we'll tie that into kind of the existing processing scenario in terms of forest practices and how we try to deal with implementing the voluntary guidelines for squirrels.
Not the least of the technical difficulties
we've had today. Yeah. So western gray squirrels are a pretty unique species. They're the largest of the native squirrels we have here in Washington. They average 700 to 900 grams, which is roughly a pound and a half to 2 pounds. So they're pretty good size. They're distinguished by their silver gray coat and white belly, large tail, and big ears. And one of the unique distinguishing features between them and an eastern gray squirrel is the coloration and how large and bushy their tail is by comparison, as well as the belly markings on an eastern are going to be a little more orange. So historic range here in Washington was definitely more extensive than it is now. They were mostly covered most of the east side of the Cascade area, as well as the Puget Trough filtering down through into the Klickitat region. More recently, that extensive area has shrunk significantly due to landscape level changes, and we've got the North Cascades population up in Okanagan, Twisp, and Winthrop area that remains. Puget Lowlands, we've got its population on Joint Base Lewis and Accord, where they've actually been doing a fair amount of research in our agency, as well as some transplanting and translocation efforts to bolster that population. And we've also got the Klickitat population down in spilling into Skamania County a little bit as well. So they rely on primarily ponderosa pine and Oregon oak and Douglas fir habitat types. There is a fair amount of variation in the type of habitats that they can take up residence in. Ponderosa pine, woodlands, savannas, the South Sound region has a little bit more interface of oak and kind of the traditional oak woodlands. and you've got some drier mesic mixed conifer forests like up in the Okanagan region, you get out of that oak zone and into primarily a pine, Douglas fir mixed system. They do definitely occupy some different habitat types. And they build stick nests or drays throughout the forest. And cavity nest trees are important for natal dense sites. Where those aren't available, they will also nest in the actual stick nest that they built. Some of their food sources include Hypogeus fungi, which is basically truffles, pine seeds, acorns, Doug fir seeds, other mast sources, and insects. So with that, I wanted to transition to a little bit on the board history. Again, back to Mark.
So as you've already been told, the Western Gray Squirrel was listed by the Washington Wildlife Commission as threatened in October of 1993. In 96, the board considered the Western Gray Squirrel for rulemaking. The board's wildlife committee initiated work in drafting proposed rule concepts, and the board asked that those concepts be analyzed in an EIS that was being prepared for primarily the Northern Spotted Owl Marbled Murrelet. The draft EIS was published in January of 95. Public hearings were held around the state, and oral and written testimony was received on the Western Gray Squirrel. The final EIS was published in May of 96. The board did not propose rulemaking for the Western Gray Squirrel. The TFW landscape group looked at the broader landscape planning for the Western Gray Squirrel and made a presentation at the August 1996 meeting. And Wildlife committed to working with the TFW Landscape Committee to address the Western Gray Squirrel via a landscape planning process.
Which has led us into how we try to manage for squirrels now. It's a voluntary management process, as you know. And process-wise, typically, the forest practice application kind of starts everything off. Landowners submit the FPA to DNR, and DNR and our agency screen those forest practices for potential Western Gray Squirrel presence and or habitat, along with many other species. If it looks like there's potential for Western Gray Squirrels to be present at that location, we'll do a nest survey if that needs to occur, if we don't have distribution information for that vicinity. We talk with landowners and share our Western Gray Squirrel management recommendations that our agency has developed and updated in August of 2010. And we work with the landowners to develop a Western Gray Squirrel management plan that they're agreeable to. The contents of those plans can vary widely depending on what the landowner's goals are in terms of, are they just going to thin out a few trees? Do they want to do a clear cut, et cetera?
Who does the survey? Is it?
Actually, I've wound up doing a lot of the surveys the last couple of years. Historically, before I was into the role I have now, there were consultants available more readily that landowners could hire, which of course is another added expense for them. In a voluntary process, it's hard to force them into paying for a squirrel survey. You know, that affects their bottom line in terms of, you know, what they might try to get out of their harvest activity. So I've done those surveys a lot the last couple of years myself. And so we work with the landowners to develop a management plan that works for them and still provides some protection. And then once we finalize that plan, I try to get a copy of that plan to DNR and to other stakeholders. Like in the Klickitat region, the Yakima tribes, pretty actively involved in managing for Western Gray Squirrels as well. So some of our goals for habitat management plans is to retain patches of habitat around the nest trees. If there's a cluster of nest trees, where we can retain a larger patch that we would refer to as a primary habitat under our current PHS recommendations. And we're going to do that and retain large conifers and to the extent we can, and oak and other cavity trees. And another pretty important element that's sometimes it's hard to capture if market conditions or other factors are playing into the timing of when they would want to do their activity. We do what we can to work with them to avoid activities during the breeding season, which for Western Gray Squirrels is from March through August. And other considerations when we're designing kind of what the harvest would look like in relation to the habitat retention patterns, we look at proximity to the water, and elevation, slope, if there's RNZs that will help tie everything together, all of those elements are things that we try to consider when we're developing plans. And so we'll get on to our recommended actions and what we think we should try to do.
In looking at the rule petition to the board, we assessed a number of things, and what we're going to want to try to do here is just kind of lay out again, as I said before, what DFW is going to do that we have the ability to do ourselves in relation to the issue at hand, and also what we're going to recommend to the board. Before we get onto this next slide, though, what I would say is that the petition seems to, now Mr. Kavanaugh relates in his handout to a lot of habitat issues, which we understand, and we understand that habitat is an issue and that you can't just have nest trees without any habitat around if the species isn't going to be viable on that local landscape unless you have habitat to go on the nest trees. In regards to the specific nest tree protection, though, there are things that we can do. But looking back at the actual FPA that kind of initiated this discussion, and from my perspective, the petition, that particular forest practice application was an anomaly in that I don't think we've ever had that situation, or maybe even close to that situation, occur in the past. It was kind of like the perfect storm in terms of FPAs, where for a number of confounding reasons and complicating factors, it was one of those rare instances that slipped through the cracks, so to speak. And so we're going to look at ways, we've already looked at ways to plug that, and working with DNR to make sure the FPA review and the screening processes are sound and solid, and if there aren't any holes, occasionally there's some hiccups in the database, etc. But we've talked to DNR about those a long time ago, and those are have been fixed to my knowledge, and we continue to work with DNR to make sure that there aren't any holes for things to fall through such as this. And as I said, I don't think that there's ever been a case where we've had a forest practice application that resulted in on the ground things like the removal, complete removal of habitat in addition to a handful of nest trees. With what we're going to do as an agency, and I mentioned that we have some current concerns about the way that our statute is worded, but along those lines, what we can do is we can examine, and we have started that already previous to this situation, a look at modifying our own statute language that would allow us as an agency to enforce it much more effectively. The other thing that we have started is to provide more structured guidance to our regional folks so that they can help our enforcement program enforce our statute, our nest protection statute. So it's kind of like what you need to do as a biologist, whether it's Gary or somebody else in the region, what you need to do and not do if it looks like we're going to have to investigate a possible violation of our statute. And then the other thing, the third bullet that we're currently undergoing and this is a statewide effort to reassess how we divide up workload amongst our regional staff, and that has some promise in terms of hoping to bring some more staff resources to the area, at least down in Klickitat County, and specifically to help with Western Gray Squirrel FPAs and help Gary, because right now Gary's about the only person that does that work, and it just costs more to travel down there to do that work, and it's not really efficient. So we're looking at those three changes in terms of DFWs, you know, what we can do and what we can bring to the table. Now, for a number of reasons that I'll go through in a minute, we don't currently support or think that a nest protection rule at the forest practices rule level is necessary. And as I said before, the FPA is unique. Just because we have nest trees doesn't give us habitat, doesn't give us functional habitat. I think it would create some confusion amongst landowners, particularly small landowners. I know we heard from Adrian in terms of Longview's knowledge, and they're not the only company, the large industrial company down south that we work with, that really knows squirrel habitat and we have really good working relationships with. I think the harder part is the small landowners. And if you have a nest protection rule that just protects the nest trees, some people tend to gravitate towards that and think that that's all that they need to do to protect the species. And so I think it would create some confusion, not to mention some possible conflicts with our nest protection statute that we hope to be revising. And there are also some implementation difficulties when people like Gary and our regional staff go out to a site and try to develop a management plan with a particular landowner. Sometimes there are nest structures that are old that don't wind up getting protected. And so if you have a nest protection rule, it gets, believe it or not, relatively complicated when you go to put it on the ground, or just developing the rule that makes sense if you can develop it, put it on the ground. There are some difficulties in discerning between eastern gray squirrel nests and western gray squirrel nests in the part of the range that those species overlap. And if you noticed on one of those slides, there was a cavity nest or a cavity in an oak tree, and there may be a nest there, there may not be a nest there, and there's just about no way to tell unless you sit on that particular site and watch or put a camera out or something. So it's just not nests that create western gray squirrel protection. And so that's kind of our assessment of moving forward with this particular petition. What we would like to do, and Mr. Kavanaugh touched on this, as far as the importance of western gray squirrel habitat in general, is that, you know, the board was recommended to not take action and allow DFW, DNR, and the stakeholders to work out habitat management planning on the ground. So we think that a better investment of our time would be to take a look at, and we haven't done this in quite a while, but maybe dig a little bit deeper than we have in the past and try to figure out ways that we can make this more effective on the ground through operational or administrative or maybe even other types of modifications, and try to get at the habitat issue more than just the nest tree issue. And scrub that pretty hard and see what improvements we can make, and provide a report back to the board in terms of the effectiveness of habitat protection through management planning. So that's our assessment. There's a number of things that we can do, both in terms of, you know, my agency, but also working with DNR to try to improve effectiveness of health protection that we already have on the books.
Questions from the board for Mark, Gary, or David on the presentation?
Was the work that the board did earlier in the 90s, was that just nest tree or was it habitat?
It was habitat. Yeah, at that point in time, I wasn't in forest practices at that point, but the landscape planning that, that Mark referred to, I think, was really in the context of the landowner landscape planning pilot project that took place back then that did not result in any formal process. And so we were going to kind of defer to that process. But at the same time, we know that protecting habitat is really complex. It's very site-specific. It's difficult to create a rule that doesn't just say, go get a plan from DFW, but that actually is prescriptive, that protects squirrels, but also maintains a level of flexibility for the landowner to operate. Very difficult. And so because of those two things combined, we did not recommend a forest practice, but it was for habitat. It wasn't just for nice trees.
No questions?
Yeah, question. What maybe you said it and I missed, but what's been the population trend for the last decade?
Overall, the population level, probably like the last decade, I would say we haven't, as an agency, had the resources to do extensive monitoring to know for sure how they're doing. My gut feeling, by having been down most in the Klickitat region landscape a lot, is that they're probably more widely distributed than we think. Again, it's, you know, you have so many small forest landowners tied in with these larger industrials, it's really hard to assess where they, what the true, you know, numbers are doing. But I would say that they're probably doing better than we might think in that landscape.
And then the second question was, how big of a buffer does a western gray squirrel require for a nesting, around a nesting tree?
For a nest tree, our prior and current recommendations ask for a 50-foot buffer around individual nest trees, as well as where you can tie
in. So a 50-foot radius.
A 50-foot radius around an individual tree as a starting point. Even that doesn't afford you functional habitat for. They need connective canopy to move around up in the trees. they don't. They try to avoid moving on the ground unless they're down eating and foraging. For the most part, they have more protection from predators if they're up in the canopy moving back and forth. So try to maintain connective corridors between nest trees, and that ties into that bigger trying to develop a primary habitat core. And there are current recommendations that they recommend a 6-acre patch of primary habitat for every 50 acres of ground that you have. So on a small forest landowner that I work with, say they have a 20-acre piece, try to scale that back to the size of their particular ownership, as well as taking in factors of adjacent properties and what the conditions are there too. So it's challenging.
Make sure
having the flexibility, like Dave mentioned, to work all of those little nuances that are very site-specific sometimes gives us more opportunity to get more protection than just having a rubber stamp, here's your rule, do this.
Any questions? Now, Paul?
So, there's a lot of information presented, and I appreciate all that. There's something I'm still not quite clear on. So your all's assertion is that the situation that prompted this particular petition is unusual and unlikely to occur again. Is that true? But in addition to that, you are taking steps to try to make sure that your statute is more clear,
right,
more easily enforceable. Okay.
And it's not just for, you know, we're talking about western gray squirrels here, but mm-hmm. our statute applies to all of protected. The way that it's structured, it applies to endangered species. If one statute does and the other statute applies to protected species, which is most of the wildlife species. So it's not just a western gray squirrel issue we're talking about.
Okay. And then what's the process by which WFW would go through? If you decided your statute needed clarification, can you talk about, you know, the likelihood of that making it through a process to actually be changed and how long that would take?
Well, I think what we're doing right now is we're assessing different language options. that that would make the statute enforceable. And you know, it just it may be a simple change, but we don't have specific language outlined yet. It would have to be obviously a legislative change to do those changes. And so that's what we would be looking at. I think, you know, like I said, we started some assessment of those statutes prior to this incident, and we're going to continue on I'm not going to speak for our department, but I mean, the obvious would be next legislative session would be the next opportunity to make those changes.
And if I may, one more question. So on the DNR side, is it possible? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of investment and time and effort on DFW and DNR's part to work with landowners to come up with site-specific plans for managing squirrels. Is there a way to condition a forest practices permit so then that plan needs to actually be followed, and then DNR has an enforcement tool if the plan is not followed as agreed to?
Good question for Mark.
Yes.
And,
yeah, so if the landowner attaches a plan to a forest practice application, then that plan becomes part of the forest practice application.
So that's current practice.
Mm-hmm. One point of clarification, and I appreciate that question. That's one thing that we intend to investigate thoroughly in our assessment, because in the past, what typically can happen is we will develop a plan with the landowner, and for the way that I understand it is that we can ask them or request them to then request DNR that they put the plan as conditions on the app. But if they don't want to do that, we're not quite sure if we can make that happen or not. So there's a bit of an illegal issue that we're going to dig into. But typically what happens if we understand from working with the landowner that they don't want to provide habitat protection through the voluntary mechanism, that we work as hard as we can to come to a solution. But if we can't, that's when we ask DNR to put conditions on the application that they can then enforce. So it there's a little bit of a give and take from us and the landowner. And if they're agreeable, then there's one road for that. And if they're not agreeable for habitat protection, there's another avenue for that. And we need to make sure that we go down both of those roads to figure out how to make basically the plans more enforceable and more effective. And that's the goal.
So I think that maybe a way to tie that together is that the conditioning authority is a little, it has boundaries on it right now. And so if the landowner chooses to submit the plan as part of their application, then it becomes a condition of the application. And sometimes folks choose not to do that. And DFW has some recourse options in that event. Some of that may pertain to application conditioning and some not. Like a material damages letter is a good example. Other questions for panel?
I had just a quick question. You showed the range of the Western Gray Squirrel going down like almost to Mexico.
Oh, that was just in Washington.
Well, you had
a little side.
Yeah. So, how far is the range?
About that far, as far as I understand.
Is there a sort of a center of population within that range, or is it fairly distributed?
Northern California and Oregon have a lot of
population.
They actually have a hunting season still in Oregon.
Yes.
Pardon, what was that?
They have a hunting season for Western Gray Squirrels.
Good question.
That answered it.
just a little, another little piece of information, and I don't recall which year it was, but I think there was a petition of the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the Washington population as a separate, distinct population segment because of the Columbia River. And at least at that point, I don't remember, I know that they didn't list, but I don't recall the exact rationale as to why it wasn't a kind of a listable entity under their DPS policy.
Okay. need to get to the action item here, folks. We've got one more item of business. I've kept you a while longer than I'm not quite yet longer than I intended. So do we have a proposed action, proposed motion on the response to the petition? Again, our parameters are to deny the petition, to deny with some instructions to staff, or to accept the petition. And the nature of the decision to accept the petition is to initiate rulemaking with the law.
I would make a motion. And I don't know if there's anything coming up. But based on our assessment and everything that we have presented here today is really the rationale for what I'm about to propose. And I would move that the Forest Practices Board deny the petition for rulemaking dated April 11th, 2013, to create a new forest practices rule similar to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Authority to protect the nest trees of the Western Gray Squirrel. I also further move that the board direct staff to work with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to explore operational, administrative, or other mechanisms to increase the effectiveness of the current Western Gray Squirrel voluntary protection approach and provide their findings to the board at its November 9th, 2013 meeting.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Motion's been moved and seconded. Discussion on the motion.
So I appreciate engaged members of the public coming forward and raising issues with the board. And you know, protection of the species is a substantive issue. I also appreciate that the department is Department of Fish and Wildlife is taking seriously the issues that have been raised. And I would like us to, you know, take some time, have some time at the November meeting to, you know, consider your findings and reconsider whether or not rulemaking is necessary. And maybe it's not in the particular form of this petition just focused on nest trees, but that we, you know, potentially, if required, and if not, no big deal, but if required, take a look at some landscape planning approaches. So rather than having it be purely voluntary, you know, having it be necessary to engage in a process to look at landscape planning specifically for Western Gray Squirrels, so keep as much flexibility as possible on a landowner basis, but not have it be so voluntary on whether or not to protect the habitat. So this is just something that, you know, I want to note for the record. That it's great from an efficiency perspective to use voluntary planning whenever possible, and I think it's warranted to take some time to see if we can fix existing procedures. But I also don't want to slam the door on the possibility that these things just aren't working enough, and we have a species that is state listed, and that we're not doing our jobs.
If I may respond, and I agree. I hope I didn't give the impression that we were slamming the door and that was all that we were going to do, but based on the findings in our report in November, then that would provide next steps. And there are a number of possibilities beyond that if we find out that particular, those avenues are not viable. So to me, I guess I kind of look at this November meeting as possible beginning of maybe a little bit longer effort, more engaged effort by stakeholders as well as the board.
Further discussion on the motion? Tom?
I just wanted to point out that the motion has some good stuff to it about directing board staff to work with WDFW, but Dave pointed out that WDFW is already doing some work, and it's not reflected in the motion because we're not directing the right DFW to do anything. But you mentioned staff guidance, looking at changing the statute and improving staff resources. So, I understand that will be happening concurrently with this. If it's, and I appreciate Paula's comments that this isn't closing the door in rulemaking, but if this comes before us again with a rulemaking component, I'd sure like to know what that would look like, because I mean that's one of the problems here. I'm not really sure if we did go that direction, what would that look like?
And if there
maybe in November we'll have a
right. And depending upon on what we find as we dig into this. If it's needed at that point in time, we were going to provide a lot more information on a number of topics related to squirrel habitat so that the board was more informed, but we didn't have a lot of time on the agenda. I'm sure we've already gone over that.
Just a comment. Over the years, we've struggled with landscape level problems, and I agree with the point that was made earlier about when you start to protect nest trees, it sends the wrong message that isn't really going to accomplish everything we need to. We might send the wrong message, but we had landscape planning, we had watershed analysis, we had efforts over the years, and I'd encourage the department, WDFW, to think about a structure for either a voluntary or a regulatory process, preferably voluntary if we get there, that does look at landscape level habitat protection, because that's really what's needed. And so I think that's what Paul was saying, and I'd be interested in hearing more about that. And perhaps it's already contained within the guidelines for management, but I think that's a direction that we need to be thinking about.
I can't agree more. And we're thinking about that in terms of a possible next step after this.
Okay. Call the question. The motion on the floor is to deny the petition we received regarding Western Gray Squirrel with instructions to staff to, as reads up there, report back at the November 2013 board meeting with their findings. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Abstentions. Thank you very much. We have what I estimate to be about 15 minutes of business to do on the last work item of the day. That's the CEMER 2014 work plan and budget. Right, I'm not missing anything now that I've completely rejiggered the agenda. First up in that docket is public comment on the CEMER 2013 work plan and budget. And there isn't any, which is shocking. Jim, you're the hot ticket of the day. Please join us and talk us through the proposed 2014 work plan and budget. And I note for members, the materials from today in the folder contain kind of an updated table, which gives you a nice overview of projects and the other cost components in the program. Jim's got the floor, folks. I know I'm keeping you, but let's keep it tight here.
Chair, members of the board, my name is Jim Hotbed, and I'm your Adaptive Management Program Administrator. And I guess I'll either be your best friend or your worst friend, depending on whether we'll leave early or we'll leave late. Let me go ahead and see if I can at least get my part done in 10 minutes, and then if there's questions and so forth, we can answer those. Just to remind you of what the process is CEMER actually starts around November to December revising the work plan and developing the new budgets for projects, both existing projects as well as projected projects. And so the numbers you see before you now actually are approved by CEMER at the end of February, so these are already a few months old. CEMER then sends the revised work plan as well as the budget to policy. Policy deliberates, and they then approve or revise, which they have this year, revise the budget in April, the 1st of April, and then every year the budget and work plan come to you folks in the main meeting. And so the revisions actually started almost 6 months ago, 5 months ago, for what you have here. So let me go to the 2014 work plan first, and I guess I have a question. Do you all have hard copies? Okay, so you've gotten good, because I tend to refer to pages. Let me first start, though, reminding you how the work plan is organized. If you look at the table of contents, the work plan is organized by rule groups. And then within each rule group, you have a number of different programs, which the colored
flow chart provides an illustration of. And so you might have rotatorials as a program, effectiveness monitoring as a program, extensive status and trend monitoring as a program, and intensive monitoring as a program. And so if you go to your table of contents, I'm going to use an example. I'm going to spend at least one more minute than I normally do on the examples. If you go to your table of contents, you see that 6.2 starts with the type N riparian prescriptions rule group. So there you have your rule group. If you look at 6.2.1 and 6.2.2, those are two different rule group, I shouldn't say rule group, rule tool programs. So under this chart, first column are rule tools, and then you have projects under the rule tool programs. And so 6.2.1, 6.2.2 are both rule tools with projects underneath those. 6.2.3 and 6.2.4 are effectiveness programs, okay? Effectiveness monitoring programs. So for example, 6.2.3 is type N riparian effectiveness program. And you've been approving quite a few type N effectiveness projects in the last few years, including today, if you approve them. And then you notice under those, you have a large number of projects. And then if you go to 6.2.5, you see the third column of the flow chart, which is extensive riparian status and trends monitoring. So the point being that if you're going to look at the work plan, which I know some of you have because you told me you have, is once you get used to looking at the table of contents, it becomes easier to understand. And it also, it essentially became my Bible. I now totally understand the work plan, even though it's as thick as it is. And I can find just about anything because I understand how the table of contents is organized. So I don't know if that helps or not. But that's the organization of the work plan. And then at the end, and I think I saw somebody unfold the table. You have a table with 99 projects on it. Every single one of those projects is in the work plan. It's at the end of the work plan, it's not the budget sheet. And you needed to bring your reading glasses to read it. And what? 180, it's way back.
186.
Oh, God.
So there's 99 projects in the work plan. There's 99 projects on this table in the same order as in the work plan. Or at least we do the best, Seamer does the best he can to keep everything in the same order. This table can be used for a number of things. Number one, it shows the status of every single project. It shows whether or not it's meeting, which ones of the FFR goals that it's meeting, whether it's fish, amphibians, or water quality. And then it indicates which of the resource objectives and targets that the project is addressing. And in some cases, projects are addressing multiple objectives and targets. The other use of the table that it could be used for is to look down any column and see if there's any gaps. Are there objectives or targets for which we haven't designed or thought of projects yet? So anyway, that table is at the end. So that's the work plan. So let's go to the budget and go to page 16 through 17. Projects that Seamer and Policy are recommending that you adopt are on pages 16 and 17. The by rule group, as well as projected costs.
There are 17 projects. Three of these projects are extensions of either existing or recently completed projects. And they're the BCIF project at the top, and the West Side Type N Buffer Effectiveness Hard Rock. And the reason, and you approved these projects last year as well, the extensions, but the point is that on these projects, there was 2 years of pre-harvest sampling, harvest, and then only 2 years of post-harvest sampling. And many people believe that 2 years wasn't sufficient time to really monitor recovery. And so a recommendation last year was made by policy that some of these projects, we have extended monitoring on these projects beyond what was in the original study designs. And that's these three projects. And then just to let you know, there's three projects out of the 17 that are either in ISPR or have come out of ISPR. In other words, independent scientific peer review. So they're basically completed, final drafts, and now being peer reviewed. And then there's one, there's five to be, what I call, I don't want to call them new, but they're to be initiated. One is the Unstable Slope Criteria Project. There's a Forest Wetland Mitigation Project. There's a West Side Type F Riparian Prescription Effectiveness Project. A Road Prescription Scale Effectiveness Monitoring Project. And an extensive status and trends monitoring vegetation rather than temperature project. And you'll notice that the cost of all these projects is about $2.3 million, and that includes the CEMER staff cost at Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. Under project support, you'll notice there's a line. I believe it's not in this table. Yeah, under project support, there's a line titled policy information / analysis, grant writer, facilitation. Last year what you did is you approved policy information analysis and a grant writer. During the course of the year, we hired facilitators for policy, and then we paid for the facilitation out of that amount of money. This year, policy's asking, rather than $50,000, they're asking for $150,000, not to exceed $150,000, for potential facilitation of policy meetings, the regular meetings, plus any subcommittee meetings where we might have some fairly hot issues that facilitation would help. So on the revenue side, there's sufficient revenue to support the request. The total is about $5.1 million. $232,000 of that coming out of general fund state from DNR, $4.5 million from the Forest and Fish Support Account, $220,000 from an EPA grant that DOE got approximately 3 years ago, and then $148,000 that Department of Ecology provides from its pass-through monies. And I expect, this is again a projection, but the fund balance at the end of the year, fiscal year 2014, would be $2.1 million.
Okay, so a couple things. Thanks, Jim. Back to our discussion we had at the sort of legislative wrap-up earlier today. Bear in mind, if it wasn't made obvious enough, that by and large, the costs associated with adaptive management program are from a Forest and Fish Support Account. There isn't a whole lot of reason to believe, as far as the legislature goes, that we're going to have a lot of sort of tampering with the Forest and Fish Support Account monies. And so I think the numbers that this budget is based on, as far as revenue, are fairly solid, in case any of you were wondering that. Jim, you said the policy made a recommendation of a $100,000 expenditure on continued, $150 or $100 on continued facilitation cost,
$150? Total amount $150 for that line.
Okay. And that's a not to exceed number?
That would clearly be a not to exceed number. We currently actually have a contract with the current facilitators for $150,000. But the way it's structured is through work orders. And so the 150 is not to exceed. The first work order was for $50,000, and it was for facilitation through April. We have a new work order for facilitation through June. The idea being, if you didn't approve the budget, that part of the budget, then they're done at the end of June, at the end of the fiscal year. And so the intent would be to have a contract of X amount, but to work with work orders. For example, we wouldn't know if we could end up with a project that goes into dispute resolution, in which case we might want to retain a facilitator or a mediator. In that case, it would be a new work order.
And I think we've heard from the reports from policy the value that facilitation has brought to the function of that group. I'm a believer. I also think, though, at some point we need to be able to do that ourselves in the program. It may not be a permanent expenditure. So I'm comfortable, I guess, if others are, with the not-to-exceed numbers. And it's not any indictment of whether I think the process has been valuable up to this point, but I want to just flag that for folks that that is an ongoing expense, at least for the period of this fiscal year's budget. I think it's a good investment. We need to think about whether that's a permanent thing or not and make that decision consciously instead of just letting it roll over. On your table with the individual projects, this is in your folder, day of folder, and I see, and I'm appreciative that we have a 2013 approved project budget or expected expenditures compared with actual 2013 projected expenditures. And the reason I'm appreciative of that is that, you know, with this docket of projects and the anticipated future docket of projects as we ramp up to trying to meet the settlement agreement master schedule, we need to be evaluating whether we're able to perform and move these projects forward at the pace that we anticipate, and if not, whether the board needs to consider other things to get the pace to what we anticipate we need it to be to meet the project schedule. So I'm noticing here we've got Eastside type N record and effectiveness study that we thought we were going to spend $75,000 on, we spent zero on. We've got an Eastern Washington riparian assessment project, $50,000 that we didn't spend any money on. We've got solar radiation effectiveness shade project, $39,000 that we didn't spend any money on. We've got an unstable slopes criteria evaluation and development. Similarly, zero expended. And we've got a forested wetlands effectiveness study with zero expended. So can you help me understand
why? So it's a mix. Yeah, so there's a mix. So I'll try to remind you to use line numbers. So let me use the zero. The Eastside Type N Riparian Effectiveness Project is line 15. It had a zero. The intent there for the $75,000 was that we hope at the beginning of last year to use the lean process to develop a study design. At the time, we didn't know if we would need to hire a contractor as part of that. In the meantime, one of the SEMR staff has taken the lead on that, so they're already paid for. We don't need the $75,000 for them. And we actually do have help, outside external help, but rather than through a contract, it's through one of the participation grants. It's with the WFFA is supporting a retired Forest Service scientist from the east side, and that person is helping with that twig. And that's why we didn't need the $75,000.
So that one's moving, right?
Yeah, and that one's moving.
Okay.
On the ERAP, it's a different story. We have a SEMR staff that's doing the analysis and the rewriting and the writing on ERAP. Again, the $50,000 is a placeholder. The intent there was they weren't sure whether or not they would need to address forest health. And the SEMR staff don't have the resources to address the scientific backgrounds, to address SEMR health. So what they wanted was I call it placeholder money in the event they needed to hire a contractor to help them. And they didn't. And so that's why there's nothing spent there. Line 26, solar radiation effective shade. That $39,000 is actually a savings that was intended to be paid to a contractor, but the program manager was able to end that project sooner than later, and so we actually saved $39,000 on a project. Let's see. Unstable streams. Was there, am I an echo or was there
an echo?
Yeah, oh, there's an echo.
Moving back a little bit.
There
you
go.
34,
line 34, unstable slopes criteria evaluation and development, that $50,000, again, placeholder money for a SAG in the event that they needed to contract outside help. That SAG is currently not functioning, and so that project hasn't gone anywhere.
For what reason? Participation or?
Participation, yeah. And the other zero is the wetlands management zone effectiveness monitoring. Again, $75,000 was placeholder in the event that wet SAG needed to contract. That project, though, has been held up a little bit because of the settlement agreement and as part of the master schedule, which you'll see either later this year or next year. A new project was inserted, which is developing a wetland strategy. So the idea here is we have line 43, wetland systematic literature synthesis. A draft is currently in WetSag. So between the synthesis and what comes out of the synthesis and what comes out of the strategy, we may change the order of some of the wetlands projects, including this one that had the $75,000. So we're trying to be a little bit smarter about the wetlands studies themselves. And in fact, if you recall, you directed me to hire a wetland scientist to work in the wetlands arena at your February meeting.
That was the hiring process, Bill.
Had it, yeah.
Okay.
Because I've been busy doing this, doing work for policy on postmortem. Also working on a non-consent or a non-CEMER science policy at the request of policy at the request of policy as well, and hiring a project manager. So this is once this meeting's over, the scientist comes priority comes out pretty quick.
How closely, as far as the projects that are on 14, how closely is the alignment between that and what's in the sort of draft version of the master project schedule for the settlement agreement?
Perfectly aligned.
Relatively.
Yes. And so the other thing you'll notice that I did this year, and this is so that you can see what happens in years out, is I included projects from the master schedule that started any time before 2020. So let me give you an example. Okay, so an example is line 30, where you have an extensive riparian status and trends monitoring in 2016. You have another one in line 45, wetlands management zone effectiveness monitoring that starts in 2019. So what I did is I took the master schedule and took all the projects that started any time before 2020 and included on the spreadsheet, even though there's no budget for those yet. That way you can kind of see the suite coming at you in the next 5 to 10 years.
The wave.
The wave up train.
Yeah.
Yeah, the big wave is,
the train.
Is coming here.
Yeah, the train's gone.
Okay. Any other questions for Jim? I didn't mean to monopolize the question period, except I did mean to monopolize the question period, and then the reason for that is that I want us to, you know, really be able to track a little bit of what we intend to accomplish in the program, and then I'm looking for, and it's not germane to the budget discussion, so I'll beg your indulgence, but I'm looking for the regular adaptive management program review reports to the board that we, if there's a status change in a project that we thought we were going to be moving on a particular timetable, you know, we gotta know whether that's working the way we intended or not. And particularly, you know, we've talked here and approved a set of pilot projects to use the lean process for study initiation. And those are just now starting to come in front of policy. Sounds like it was a little bumpy on the first discussion of a type N project. And if we're gonna, though, be successful in ramping up the number of project falls that Seymour has in the area over a given period of time. You've got to kind of have all this come together. So that's the reason for me to, you know, slog you with this a little bit, because this is the inner workings of whether we're going to be able to meet the obligations of settlement and frankly, and the obligations of Horse and Fish. Other questions for Jim? Everyone's plenty worn out. So that leaves us with an action item. On the 2014 Seymour Work Plan and Budget, which maybe come up on the screen here in the form of potential motion language. I think this is another where I'll probably exercise my privilege to initiate the motion. I move the Forest Practices Board approve the 2014 Seymour Work Plan and Budget. Lo and behold, there it is.
That's cheating.
Have a second on the motion.
I'll second.
Thank you. Motion's been made and seconded. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, I call a question. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Abstentions. Thank you all, ladies and gentlemen. This will conclude our public meeting, and we will go into a brief executive session. So what I'm going to do, just for the sake of all of us who have been sitting here gestating after lunch, is give you about 10 minutes, and let's maybe let's come back here for a quick update and three. So give yourself a little bio break for a second.
So you're going to be the costume.
Oh, man. All right.
That's okay.
Yeah, either push side. We may have to move forward.